and unfortunately Phil Austin and Aries. And we improvised together, and something magic happened. And here we are, 50 years later, Dave Osman and I still around releasing funny Fireside Theater material.
And we're still doing it here every Tuesday at 1 o'clock for Phil and Ted's Sexy Boomer Show, the only station that will have us, KPFK FM.
Live on, KPFK!
There were 10 little bozos sitting on a bus. One joined the Navy, now there's 9 of us. 9 little bozos sitting in the draft. One went crazy and the rest all laughed.
Welcome to KPFK. Established in 1959 on the Pacifica Radio Network, a broadcast service of, by, and for the people. 90.7 FM Los Angeles, 98.7 Santa Barbara, 93.7 San Diego, and 99.5 Ridgecrest, China Lake. People power is on your radio.
Welcome to Beneath the Surface. I'm Susie Wiseman. Today we hear from UC Berkeley sociologist Dylan Riley, who's written a great deal about fascism and far-right politics. We have just elected to the presidency a man who has been characterized as a fascist and a dire threat to democracy and constitutional rule as we know it. We'll get Dylan's understanding of the specificity of Trump's politics, the basis of his support, the radical fascistic measures his administration intends to carry out, including the frightening Project 2025, and how Trump fits in with analogous movements of the far right around the world. We'll also get Dylan's view of MAGA's reactionary gender politics and the reactionary vision of the family that sees women's advances at the expense of men and their traditional family role. There's much more when our program returns in just a moment. Welcome to Beneath the Surface. I'm Susie Wiseman and really pleased to bring Dylan Riley back with us. It's been a little bit of time and Dylan has been particularly intellectually active. And I thought, given the situation that we're in, this is a perfect time to talk to Dylan. Dylan Riley is professor of sociology at the University of California at Berkeley. He's the author of The Civic Foundations of Fascism in Europe. Also the author of Microverses, Observations from a Shattered Present, and another new book that I didn't even know about, but I'm just ordered, Perdita. But many, many, many articles, including in 2018, What is Trump? Most of his articles are in New Left Review, and I'm sure in all of the prominent sociological journals. And Dylan is also an editor at New Left Review. We had Dylan on with Robert Brenner about a year ago, a little bit more, when they both wrote The Seven Theses on American Politics, which is still creating a lot of discussion, controversy, new ways of thinking, and I'm sure some of that will filter here. But so, Dylan, let's just start. You've been writing a lot on fascism and far-right politics, and now we've just elected a man who has been characterized as a fascist by his critics, including those who have served in his first administration. Trump admires authoritarian strongmen, including fascists. He's an American nationalist. He scapegoats immigrants. He would love to be an authoritarian dictator. He says that. He's charismatic and he enjoys genuine popular support. He's also constructed a personality cult revolving, well, around himself. And he's also an entertainer. He's chaotic. He's undisciplined. He's obsessed with being the greatest. And he promises more nationalist, xenophobic, racist, and misogynist radical politics. Very importantly, in this election, he won a lot more working class support. But he's not pro-worker, and he would very happily bust unions. So there's some contradictions that will be emerging. And I'm wondering, Dylan, just to begin, is this a kind of fruitful discussion about whether or not he's really a fascist that will help us understand what the next 4 years might bring?
I'm just going to say, if people find it politically useful to call him a fascist, call him a fascist. Like, I don't, you know, if you're thinking about historical fascism, it's a very different syndrome. But fundamentally, in my view, it's not really a political question. I completely convinced that the Trump phenomenon poses a really, really serious threat to basic freedoms. And I think it's much clearer this time around than it was in 2016, primarily just because of the degree to which there's a really concrete plan and a kind of also theory of leadership that is very, very out there and explicit and can be seen. You know, I think that Trump and the people who are around him know what they're up to in a way that they did not 8 years ago. So that's just where I am on this. I would hold to the point that, you know, in the 1930s, there were these very important, you know, there's just very important differences. I think the geopolitical environment was different. I think the class basis, actually, of Trumpism is a bit different. I think that the kind of organizational structures of classic fascism are quite different. So I think all that stuff holds. Nevertheless, it's quite right to say, okay, this is the form that something like that politics of the 1930s, this is the form that it assumes in the early 21st century. I'm totally comfortable with saying that. I mean, it's a bit of a problem because I think that the term fascism can be used both in a political sense and an analytic sense, and they don't quite go together. But in one sense, I would like to avoid the definitional debate altogether and say, this person is a serious, I mean, not just this person, but we'd say MAGA politics and its analogs is a really, really dire threat.
That's actually exactly where I wanted to go. And I mean, I do want to pick up on one thing about his base in a minute, but yeah. I think the real issue is, you know, that we should pay attention to what Trump says. And yes, he said that he threatened to assume, you know, the position of a dictator on day one. Maybe he kind of left it out there that it would only be on day one, but that's rather absurd. And so you just said that he represents a dire threat. And I think that's the threat. Certainly the Harris campaign ran on the threat to democracy, and that didn't land well. It didn't do much for her, which leaves open another question. But I guess right now you just said that it's a dire threat. Let me just go into this, you know, a little bit, because he's declared that he wants to end U.S. democracy as we know it. Yeah. He doesn't say it. He's often so inarticulate or wide ranging in his, you know, utterings that we can't really, you know, yeah, hold him to what he says. But on the other hand, we get the idea. So let's get your assessment. Do you think he will actually move to curtail U.S. democracy and freedom and tax on freedoms? And if so, how do you see these changes coming about? And I want to add just one further thing to that. Trump won legitimately, and he won the popular vote. That's obviously going to make him feel better. And maybe, you know, he's always operating on grievances and he may still do that. But I think within that question is, since he was able to win in the system as it is established, do you think he'll, it's hard to know, but do you think he'll try to end it in the way that he would have when he thought that he'd been cheated?
Yeah, I mean, I think so. On the rhetoric of democracy is actually, I've looked really pretty closely, especially at the foreword to the mandate for leadership document called Project 2025, but the conservative promise. Obviously, the document is a sprawling kind of policy document. A lot of it, it's important to sort of absorb it all. There's a lot of detail and so on. But actually, I think what's been less discussed is the sort of theoretical framework that we are dealing with here. And that's, I think, as an initial take, a good way of figuring out what is actually the project here. So, because we have very little else to go on. It's, you know, obviously, as you said, Trump's utterings are hard to interpret sometimes, but this is actually a project. And if you just look at the document, what you see the term, what does the term dictatorship mean and how are they thinking about it? And the what they are thinking about is the idea of an emergency regime that is going to destroy particularly the administrative, what they call the administrative state, and then return sovereignty to the, you know, healthy, purified populace, right? This is the idea. So, of course, it's anti-democratic in the sense of, you know, attacking the institutions, but it is all of it also bound up in the rhetoric of democracy as returning sovereignty to the true people. So, like, I think that's really important to see. And I think that when you say dictator on day one, I actually think we should take that phraseology really seriously. What is a dictator supposed to do? You know, going back to the Roman Empire, the dictator is an emergency regime that arises to restore the kind of political balance of the community. And that is exactly the way that the Trump administration is going to think about power. They are imagining themselves as a kind of inverted Leninism, you could put it that way, right? If the Bolshevik regime was meant to be a temporary democratic dictatorship that then will allow the new socialist society and a truer democracy to flourish, the analog is that in a way the Trumpists are engaged in an emergency project to restore American democracy to its unsullied past. That is the way they think about this. And I think it's worth taking that pretty seriously. That's kind of where I'm coming from on this. Yeah.
So there's a lot there to talk about within that. And that is, you know, when you say restore democracy and you say returning sovereignty to the people, it's really hard to understand all of that without first saying who the people are.
Right.
In his view, you know, we do know that there's an implicit racism, anti-immigrant sentiment, that they somehow want to create an America that in their imagination existed before there were all these people of color or these people, all different sorts of things. But let's just begin, you know, as you go through, you know, in order to bring about this proposed break from democracy, he's relying on a whole group of people. Mm-hmm. All right, politicians, we're now getting a taste of through some of the proposed appointments that are, wow, not only outside the margin, but bring up a term that I just learned yesterday, kakistocracy, which is it's a wonderful term, you know, which is about a government of very unqualified, unsuitable people.
Right.
And in that sense, we're really going to see this. But he's named them already. Can you talk about any of these people? Because I want to sort of understand who they are politically as a group and whether or not, you know, we can get something. You've already mentioned Project 2025. We will come back to that. But let's just talk about the personnel right now that he's trying to assemble for this.
I mean, I guess the key one for these particular issues that we're talking about, I think right now, is probably Matt Gaetz. Because, I mean, I think the important thing about that is that the Justice Department, this is the crucial appointment. Attorney General is really the crucial appointment for the question of, you know, really trying to take this in just a full-on authoritarian direction. Because Gaetz, who, of course, we should remember, was under investigation by the Department of Justice, essentially for soliciting prostitution from underage women and, you know, all of the kind of stuff that's going on around him. So Gaetz will be obviously charged with, you know, basically using the Justice Department as a tool of retribution against the Democratic establishment. I mean, I don't see any reason why we wouldn't expect a series of investigations and indictments of various kind of figures. I mean, I just don't see, I think that they'll certainly go after Biden's family, if not him himself. I think, you know, they'll identify a Democratic Party politicos that they want to go after. And also, of course, the FBI is their police wing, right? This is the key appointment, in my opinion, and we should keep a close watch on that. you know, other ones are very disturbing as well. But
the political class, right? That he'll go after the political class. And this will certainly occupy a lot of time with Congress and with hearings and with, you know, investigations. But
I think so.
If it's confined to that, like,
we should be so lucky, right? I mean, that's kind of that's kind of the implication of what you're saying. But my sense is that it will be the political class in the first instance, because these are people that are visible to Trump, you know, and that's, I think, what he'll be initially caring about. So that's the other one is the Homeland Security, you know, this Homeland Security and the mass deportation regime. I'm blanking on the name of that of that appointment, but he was involved in the family separation policy. You
not
know,
Stephen Miller.
Not Stephen no. Miller. It's the Secretary of the Department of Homeland Security. You know, he said obviously that he would not. You know, he wouldn't separate families because he would just deport them all together. Right. That is to say, those who in fact had citizenship and those who are undocumented. This is extremely, you know, very, very disturbing. So I think we're going to probably see maybe sort of a pincer movement from above on the Democratic Party politicos through the Justice Department, and then from below on the undocumented and not undocumented, basically just a war on migrants that is going to be engineered through the Department of Homeland Security. And so those are disturbing. Yeah.
No, go ahead. No, I was just going to say there's a lot of discussion about whether or not that is doable. And in fact, about whether a lot of his anti-democracy project is at all doable. You know, it's sort of like you've mentioned Project 2025, and we have the sort of outline of his attack on the deep state or the administrative state. And I think I saw today Ramaswamy thinks that 2/3 of government employees should be fired. And it's pretty interesting because Trump likes to talk about not causing unemployment. But if this happens, it's going to be widespread.
Right.
But on the other hand, the question, you know, even to do this mass deportation of people who many of whom are citizens born in this country or naturalized, you know, you have to upend the Constitution.
Yes, you basically have to undermine the 14th Amendment, but it's not clear. The man who I was thinking about, and I'm sorry, I've misspoken. The man's name is Homan, and he was the former ICE director under Trump. And he's being proposed as the border enforcement czar under the next administration. Of course, the Department of Homeland Security nominee is Kristi Noem, who she brings her own kind of set of issues, if we put it that way, with her. But let's return to this business about the, you know, well, this would upend the Constitution. I mean, look, so the key provision of the Constitution that's going to be upended will be the 14th Amendment, which, you know, enshrines the so-called principle of birthright citizenship. I think it's worth considering what the 14th Amendment comes out of, maybe, before we kind of want to talk about it.
Yes, please. Because, by the way, just as you're speaking, as soon as the Republicans recognized that the demographic changes in the country were not going to be favorable to their kind of politics, I'm thinking during the Bush administration, I remember Lindsey Graham saying, we have to undo the 14th Amendment. And as a constitutional scholar that he pretends to be, I found that really shocking. And now, let's go from there. Like, you know, let's talk about what it was and what it is.
So the 14th Amendment was obviously the basis of citizenship for the formerly enslaved persons after the end of the Civil War. It's one of the key Reconstruction amendments, 14th, 15th, and 16th Amendments. So the 14th Amendment says if you were born in the United States, you are a citizen of the United States, which basically then gave citizenship rights to the formerly enslaved persons of the Confederacy. And it's an absolutely key institution of what you could say civic citizenship in the United States. It's the idea that the country is a constitutional republic rather than the expression of a kind of an ethnic or racial group. And so by undermining it and by, you know, tinkering around the edges of the 14th Amendment, what you're doing is really reconceptualizing or, you know, reorganizing the very nature of what you know, you, what you think of as being an American citizen. Because obviously for the MAGA movement, American citizenship is to be accorded to those who are part of the American kind of a racial ethnic stock, right? More kind of, you say, blood and soil kind of nationalism that is being expressed here. So that's a really profound thing. And I have no confidence at all that the Supreme Court is really going to go to bat for the 14th Amendment. Remember, the other thing that they've already weakened there in the Colorado decision, because the Colorado case against Trump was a very, very straightforward case that those who had engaged in an insurrection against the Republic should not be allowed to run for federal office. This is very, very clear in the letter of the 14th Amendment. Okay, they didn't, they obviously overturned that case. So why would they now protect birthright citizenship? I have no confidence at all that the Supreme Court would do that. So I see a potential rewriting of our entire conception of citizenship. And that's very frightening.
There's something else that's also in the 14th Amendment that we saw prominently enforced, and that was the idea of due process to all persons under the law, not citizens, but persons. So I don't know if listeners will remember Plyler versus Doe, when in Texas they tried to pass, you know, a law that would not allow the children of undocumented workers to be educated. And that they would not be allowed into the schools. And the argument, you know, went and said that this is, you know, would be crazy. It would create a subclass of wandering kids in the street while their parents are at work who would not be educated, would, you know, it was just completely undemocratic. And they used the 14th Amendment to strike this down. And everything that's happened since then in the court, as you say, is very worrying. So I guess this goes to the question that I started to ask you about the kind of political and social forces, let's call about this the political forces that are prepared to try to overthrow democracy, literally using the institutions within it. Is this something, do you see those, I guess, looking at the court, looking at who's being nominated and who we might see that might defend against these kinds of, you know, this kind of an assault?
I mean, I don't. I'm just going to say, I don't see any substantial so-called guardrails. I've been incredibly struck by how weak all the kind of institutionalist arguments have been about American democracy. I don't see it. Maybe there'll be some, I mean, people are kind of making some noises about Gates, actually, in particular. So I'm just going to say, I don't really see why, in a sense, because if it's not Gates, it'll be somebody who's just as bad.
This guy who they're going to, the one that they're nominating or proposing for the Pentagon, what's the name is?
The Hegseth. The guy, he's a Fox News commentator for, I think it's for Secretary of Defense. He's being, they're considering his nomination.
A true winner.
Really alarming.
Who doesn't apparently believe in germ theory and doesn't believe we have to wash our hands and brags that he has it for 10 years. So it takes us back to the Middle Ages, essentially.
I just don't see any, you know, where would one place one's faith in the Republican Senate? I don't see that. It's also worth noting that many, many of these appointments could just be recess appointments. And it looks like, I guess Rick Scott is probably going to be leader of the Senate majority. And it looks like he's perfectly willing to go along with that.
No, it looks like I'm sorry, just this morning's paper, it's going to be Thune.
Oh, Thune. I'm sorry. Thune. Okay.
Mainstream.
Scott
came in third on the vote.
So Thune might do, you know, maybe Thune will put up some opposition. But I have a very hard time imagining that this is going to be a moment where the Senate suddenly decides to kind of find its spine and act as an institutional counterweight to the Trump presidency. I really don't see that.
Example of Mitch McConnell, who said, right, you know, Trump's a cancer on the institution. And then he, you know, voted against impeaching him. And then he threw his support behind him. So,
yeah, I don't see it, as your question indicates, that was at a time when, you know, one would have kind of expected someone like McConnell to be a big defender of the institution, because that had always been his rhetoric and persona And he doesn't like Trump. He personally, I think, very much dislikes Trump. So this is a much friendlier environment than even 2016 for these appointments. And I don't see a lot of a resistance coming from that quarter. I think our greatest hope for resistance is incoherence and infighting among the various factions of Trump world. I do think there are real contradictions there. Are they contradictions that could be understood in terms of a kind of pro-democracy wing versus an authoritarian wing? Not really. It's more like, you know, the kind of oligarchic, you know, tech bro and dirty extractive industry wing versus the kind of, you could say, you know, social right, which is organized around the base of the MAGA movement, which obviously doesn't want, in my understanding, a gutting of Social Security, at least for citizens or their group, as they would understand it. That seems to me like that's the conflict that's going to play out, and it could be a sharp conflict, but I'm not sure it's a conflict that's really relevant to this question of,
also,
you know,
just as you were saying
democracy.
That, I was thinking of the conflict between the fossil fuel industry and, say, the Musk wing that, you know, brings about electric cars, is dependent on this idea. There's a conflict there as well.
Yeah.
I don't know what you think or how important that is. But so I think all of this is fruitful to discuss the potential conflicts, because the main criterion right now, it seems to me, for Trump is blind loyalty, or just loyalty. Yeah. If you're loyal, then he'll consider you, and then your politics he'll try to shape, essentially.
I think that's absolutely right. And it actually goes back to something I wrote in the What is Trump essay, where I discussed the nature of Trump's kind of style of rule. I think the key idea, if you're trying to really understand how it works, is that it's a very anti-bureaucratic, in the sense that exactly what you're talking about is what matters for Trump above all is fealty. And the style of the administration will be highly informal. You know, instructions and commands are going to be issued verbally with the fewest number of written records produced as possible. They may not even be explicitly issued. They may be hinted at so that people, it could be a sort of analog to what happened under National Socialism. Ian Kershaw once wrote a very interesting essay talking about working toward the Führer, which, and the idea was that, you know, the Führer would sort of hint that he wanted to go in a certain direction, and then the Gauleiter and the other followers would sort of try to intuit what he really wanted through, you know, and sort of implement it kind of on their own. I think there's a certain analog there in the style of Trump's rule. So I think that's why you get this weird, like, that's why you get this strange figure like Tulsi Gabbard suddenly coming forward as you know, BNI, a figure who would remember was kind of close in some ways to the Sanders wing of the party, you know, and then has shifted into this very bizarre world.
I also think the important thing to remember about Tulsi Gabbard is that she was raised in a cult. And that, you know, even when she was part of the Sanders wing, I had good friends in Hawaii said, watch out for her. That's not what she is. She's actually an Islamophobe and on the right and cultish. So I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, I guess I'm just putting her up as an example of an oddity. Yeah. Like, if you were going to say, you know, what would be the consistent MAGA position, you would think it would be all these people who had been locked in from the beginning, but it's not going to be that, right? It's, you know, Elon Musk and Tulsi Gabbard and Matt Gaetz and a kind of, you know,
and
as you're saying,
RFK Jr.
Oh, by the way, you know, just anecdotally, there are RFK Jr. flags here in the Berkeley Hills, which, of course, is so fascinating. It's the kind of the anti-science of plank that brings together, you know, sort of new age weirdos and anti-vaxxers on the right and left. Anyway,
I don't think this is also has some analog to classical fascism, too. Right?
Absolutely. Sort of cult weirdos and people, who, you know, people involved in bizarre ideas, or, you know, you think about Goering, you know, with his kind of debauched parties and kind of homosexual proclivities and all this stuff, you know, that was sort of swirling around. And the kind of almost bohemian character of that whole group, right?
Even veganism or a form of vegetarian, all of
both.
That.
I believe it's correct to say that both Mussolini and Hitler were vegetarians, which was right. a very odd thing at that time, right? I mean, that was kind of an out there lifestyle choice in the Europe of the 1930s.
But let me ask you know, just before you go into that, because there's, you know, if you think back to January 6th, which was incredibly important, and I'd like to get your take on what, you know, that was our first example of Trump's attempt to overthrow the existing order, even though it was, you know, executed badly, and then he didn't want to take blame for it. And then he said that these are fine people, or I think that was what he said about Charlottesville, but he loved the people. I know we can expect him to pardon everybody who's in jail, but I'm asking you, Dylan, to sort of to get your ideas about what you thought of that, what do we call it, extra-parliamentarian group of stormtroopers, essentially. Is that how you see them? And what do you think that what we're going to see now is somehow the same politics, but more on in a more politically justified form?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I would say, you know, the more that we learn about what happened on January 6th, the more disturbing it becomes. I would certainly say I actually thought, you know, the sort of first run of that was like, this is very strange, but I was unclear about what the actual significance of it was. But the disturbing thing is the degree to which there was a real plan to do this, and the degree to which there was collaboration inside the institutions, that is to say, on the part of the far right. So I think that is very disturbing. My own view is that probably what's far more dangerous are going to be these inside actors who are going to attack the institutions. I don't actually think, I mean, obviously there are these radical right paramilitary elements, but their social weight is not such that I think they would have the same role as like the SA or the black shirts in Italy. Like, I'm just going to say that I doubt you're going to see like Proud Boys squads on every street corner of American cities, which is not, so that's, I'm just saying, like, cause it's just a very different context. I mean, remember that the, you know, in the classic fascisms, you have this huge population of veterans who have gone through the incredibly horrendous experience of the First World War, and they have arms and military experience, and they're deeply alienated. You don't quite have that group in the same way. But nevertheless, it's also just very clear that a large part of the Republican Party is just willing to essentially engage in coup d'etat if they lose elections. I mean, that, and they'll use this kind of little group of kind of deluded fanatics to kind of give that appearance of a popular uprising, to put it that way.
There's also the aspect, though, when you go back to classical fascism, one very important part of it was to crush the organized strength of the working class that was a revolutionary threat in Germany. And we saw, you know, in the German revolutions, repeated revolutions through 1923, that it was considered a threat. And we don't have that situation here at all. I mean, I don't mean that we have to hold him up to classical fascism, but you know, in this discussion about the Proud Boys and the role of these sort of thugs that would roam the streets, in this case, it would be maybe to assist in the roundup of immigrants. But it's really, you know, well, I guess we have to sort of understand more what it is that Trump's about, because he boasts that, you know, the Republican Party is now the party of the working class. But what kind of the working class, and what does it mean for the working class to have gone over and voted for Trump? Certainly it's anti-elitist, anti-democratic, anti-neoliberal, perhaps anti sort of, you know, the party that pretended to represent them and never really did much. And on the other hand, there's just, it's so full of contradictions, and I don't even really know how to frame the question, but I think you know where I'm going.
So I just think that, okay, so what I would say in the first instance is we can say, I think with some confidence, that non-college educated men of more or less all races swung to Trump, right? And that's a huge problem. I also think that in understanding the behavior of that group and actually in understanding a lot of what Trump is as a project, I actually think gender is a very, very important thing to discuss. So what I think is going on at kind of a deep structural level, I mean, I don't think that this necessarily explains like the particular electoral results, which are always highly contingent and depending on patterns of turnout and things. And this was a very close election, so we should sort of preface it with that. But I think at a deep structural level, one of the things that's happened basically since the early 1980s, and the New York Times actually had a really nice article about this just maybe a week or so before the election showing this, is the decline in the relative earning potential of non-college educated men. So that in 1980, they were making about 10 to 7% more as a group than the average wage. And by 2023, it was like 11% less than the median wage on average. So, and then if you look at other groups, particularly college educated women, it's an entirely different scenario. It's like the reverse, like they're going up. They're earning now quite a bit more than the average wage. So that is happening. And at the same time, obviously, you get this mass entry of women into the labor force, which has acted in part, and I think Nancy Fraser is actually really good on this, that is to say, the entrance of women into the labor force has acted in part as a way of maintaining the consumption levels of households, but now they have to be two earner households instead of one earner households. So there was the collapse of the breadwinner model. And I think what's been so toxic about that is that what has happened, at least in among a substantial part of the public, and particularly among this non-college educated group, is that the gains of women have been associated with all of the pathologies of neoliberalism. So that people see those two things as going together. And what they really dislike, and I think that this is something that the left really needs to take on board, they dislike the kind of professional, meritocratic, feminizing institutions of, you know, higher ed, to a certain extent, even corporate boardrooms, and the government. And this is an incredibly powerful basis for a reactionary gender politics. So I would say if there is something that is sort of analogous to the threat from the left of the 30s, it's this gender transformation.
And you can see a really good point, Dylan, because if it personifies who Hillary Clinton was, for example.
Yes.
You know, absolutely. Less so, I would think, or slightly less so, Kamala Harris, because, you know, she certainly was, at least when she was in the Senate and in California, she was to the left of Hillary and identified more or say less with the political class. But she ran the campaign exactly in that way. So, yeah, I think this is a really important point. I didn't mean to interrupt you. Continue with it, like how you see this playing out. So it's sort of like, because it goes along with Dobb and everything else, chain women back, you know, to
absolutely
the stove so that men can go out there and somehow replace the earnings.
So I just think it's hard for the left, because I'm going to say as a general matter, I think the left has not been good on the politics of the family and gender in particular. And the problem that, you know, in understanding MAGA politics, I mean, I would just encourage everyone again to just read those 15 or 16 pages at the beginning of the Project 2025 stuff. It's all about the family and reinforcing traditional gender roles, right? And what it's appealing to is the idea of, I think, giving men a kind of role, you know, a kind of real meaningful life with respect to, you know, their place and the family and the community and so on. And so it's just a very powerful and deeply reactionary, you know, vision. Of course, it's all mythology, the idea that there's this organic and natural family that has been violated by, you know, the so-called DEI bureaucracy and, you know, the more general advance of women in the labor market. But, you know, and think about Vance with the childless cat lady's comment on the trail. That was key to all of this stuff. And so I think that it's very important on the left that we propose a positive vision of a transformed family form, actually. I think that's a key thing to fight against, because basically I think what the lectures are seeing over and over again are various kind of, I would say, various symbols of what Nancy Fraser calls the multiple breadwinner family, right? It's the, you know, the career woman with the pantsuit kind of thing, which is, it's good in the sense that, right, it does sort of exemplify the advance of women and greater equality, but it's very bad in the sense that it's associating that all with a neoliberal kind of meritocracy, which is deeply unattractive. And so we really, like, I think that is really, really crucial. And I don't know how to offer much more than that, but.
No, I think you're absolutely right about that. Mm. But just to go to the other side of it, this notion that somehow you'll restore the traditional role of men in this society when you look at the way the society is actually organized. So this, of course, is part of the idea of bringing back manufacturing. And, you know, Biden's done a great deal to try to bring back good jobs. But Trump, even then he says that, he, you know, in his practice as a businessman and the people that he's bringing around them, they don't care if they bring back manufacturing, but they certainly don't want strong unionized jobs with benefits, protections, and higher wages. And yet, so there's that question about whether or not there's going to be some contradiction and whether or not, you know, many of the workers who have migrated to the Republican Party are not going to find it to be a hospitable home for them.
Yeah, it's hard to imagine. It's hard to imagine that this obvious contradiction is not going to just emerge and be exacerbated as they continue. So look, I think there are people kind of within the Republican orbit who understand that the right, you know, so-called right politics would be a kind of pro-worker rightist project. But there's really not any basis for that, because the Republican Party, of course, is dominated. I mean, we do spend on the left a lot of time, and justifiably so, kind of dumping on the Democratic Party and how it's in hock to financiers and so on. But the Republicans have exactly the analogous problem. I mean, they too have, it's going to be really, really difficult for them to do. I mean, can you imagine this group doing anything like even what Biden did, which was actually in some ways deeply impressive? You know, that's not going to happen. And so I think that the disaffection will be real, and I predict it'll be pretty rapid.
Let me ask you a question about education, just because I'm thinking about what you said in terms of, you know, gender and how important it is. We've known for a very long time that the majority of students in universities, not just here, but worldwide, even in Iran, have been women. Yes. Women are the ones getting college degrees. And now we're seeing a wholesale attack on education. With this regime, and it fits in partially with, I guess, this attack on bureaucracy. And there's many of us who teach who wouldn't mind, you know, some of that bureaucracy attacked. But but more than that, though, this is deeper than that. And I just wonder how you, you know, your sort of reaction.
Well, I mean, you're right. I mean, the problem is that, there's a problem with men globally. They're not graduating at the same rates. They don't do as well in school. Education is a really, really big determinant of earnings potential and happiness and health. So I sort of think that the left needs to recognize this problem much more openly and do something or offer something to it, other than saying, well, you know, men and white men in particular have had it good for so long, so they should kind of suck it up and just kind of, this is the writing of a historical injustice. I mean, that might be true, but it's really bad politics, even if it is true. I happen to think it's kind of not true, but that's neither here nor there, really, in terms of the politics. So
one thing that I could just bring into that, you know, for the left to take up in a more vocal way, which is, of course, the left is very weak, but just even social democratic left, very few people have, perhaps Bernie, but have really attacked the entire nature of the way that benefits are distributed in this society. Everything is based on not you get these rights because you're a person and you live, but based on your work. And if you didn't do enough quarters of work, you're not going to get Social Security. You're not going to get Medicare. You're right. Not going to get all sorts of benefits. And so it's like, you know, part of this so-called meritocracy in a way, but everything's dependent on what you've done or what you continue to do.
Yeah, I think I can understand your hesitation about describing it as a meritocracy. Yeah. I guess what we should distinguish is between the actual reality and the ideology. It's certainly an ideology of meritocracy. Yeah. So if we think about the notion of equity in the sort of diversity, equity, and inclusion stuff that's common on college campuses and other places, the concept of equity itself basically means that everyone should be brought up to a common level and starting point, but then, you know, natural talents will allow the cream to rise to the top. It's not really an egalitarian concept at all. It's essentially a demand for a just meritocracy, whatever that means. And that's very limited, actually, as a politics. I mean, I think we ought to start thinking about, yes, obviously what you're talking about, social citizenship. That is to say, the idea that everyone, by virtue of the fact that they are part of the community, should expect and have the right to a certain level of material and cultural and intellectual well-being, right? I also think something else. I think the whole way that we think about education has to change. And this might seem parochial or concerned because I'm a teacher, basically. But I actually think it goes more broadly because education is obviously such a massively important divide politically and socially, and it's intersecting with gender in these ways. I think we have to imagine education as a public good in the sense that really one can only be a cultivated person and have that be meaningful in relationship to other people who are also cultivated. Like we need to think about this as something that is produced and consumed, as it were, in collectively and in common, not as human capital or cultural capital, not as an individual endowment that allows me to get ahead. And yeah. I don't know, like, you know, that whole discussion is nowhere on the horizon, in my opinion. It's just all about, you know, sort of let's make it so that, like, the inequalities that we do have are somehow justified by a very problematic notion of talent or intelligence and hard work. So, you know, I think that's a really big problem. Yeah.
Dylan, I want to go back and, you know, the last in the minutes that we have left to looking again at this sort of form of fascism, if we want to call it that, that Trump represents here in the United States, and that, you know, it's a sort of fascism that manages to function within the established framework of governance, you know, and of course, in Trump's case, it's completely arbitrary. If he had lost, and then he would have, you know, recreated this whole notion that he didn't really lose, but he won. So, you know, he may be placated at least at that level. But I wondered, you know, I asked you at the very beginning if it was very useful. And I think in your article on fascism, you said it was better to look at him as a kind of patrimonial household head rather than as a kind of traditional fascist. And we can't also just confine this discussion to the United States, because we have analogous movements around the world of the far right. They call them populist. I don't know if that's the right word, but you've got a lot of political movements on the rise in around the world that are slightly different, but also have features the same. And maybe I think that discussion that you had in the New Left Review 114 from 2018 is very useful. Can you explain a little bit?
Sure. I mean, I think that we tend to be pretty parochial in the U.S. sometimes and think that, oh, well, it's all Trump and so on. And obviously, if you just raise your eyes and you look around the world, you see, I mean, even the victory of the Popular Front in France recently, which of course has now issued in a very bad outcome, essentially. Yeah. But even there, we think about that as a left victory, but that was a historic win for a party, that is to say the RN, which has its roots in former SS officers, right? So this is a very, very far-right party. So that's going on. Then in Italy, you have Giorgia Meloni's Fratelli d'Italia, which is the successor party of the initial and original Italian fascist party. And of course, Nigel Farage actually did quite well in the recent elections in the UK. Really, one of the main reasons that the Tories lost was not because there was a decline in the right-wing vote, but because the far right had hived off and become a viable organization on its own. I think it's called the Reform Party. Yeah. Then you have the Alternative for Deutschland in Germany, which, of course, it's mostly anchored in the kind of deindustrializing heartland of the eastern part of Germany. But it, too, has a very powerful base. All of these movements have, to say at least, a section of the working class that is very locked in on their politics. So this is a global movement.
Also Brazil, Argentina, there's a lot of places.
Yes. So Brazil and Argentina, the similar things, the specificity, I think, of those, let's say, of the Latin American cases, as I understand it, the specificity is, of course, that those parts of the world, and I'm thinking particularly, I guess, of Brazil here, they've never really had quite a mass industrial working class in the same way that you would have in the core capitalist countries. And you have this giant category of people who are involved in the informal economy, which gives the nature of the fascist or authoritarian experience there slightly different. In some ways, those social structures are more propitious for a kind of left populism, but it's all very unstable. So, but obviously the Brazilian Bolsonaro cannot run again, but it's likely that there will be a new figure on the far right who's kind of emerging in the Brazilian context, obviously Milei in Argentina. So, and that's a difference actually between classic fascism and whatever this contemporary wave is this is a global one. In the classic case, in the 1930s, it's very clear that the fascist experience was, broadly speaking, a phenomenon of the kind of second-comer powers, right? And a lot of the energy of the movement was against what had been in place, which was British hegemony through kind of the long 19th century, right? We don't have anything like that now. Now the same thing is happening like worldwide, and our politics are kind of resembling on even across the North-South divide, as you're pointing out. And so that's a real difference, and it's a puzzle actually for me, exactly what explains the completely global nature of this turn. So I would just say, as a general matter, it has a lot to do with the fact that the politics of what we could think of as center-left reformism under capitalism, which in the northern or rich countries takes the form of social democracy, and in the periphery and center-periphery takes the form of a development project, those politics are gone, right? And they're not coming back, and the left has not offered anything to really replace them.
This is really good. So let's go back, because we have not very much time left. And I, of course, you know, we have to come back and have this discussion again on the sort of global nature of it, because, Putin fits into this.
Absolutely. Yeah.
All kinds of stuff, you know, that we don't have time for now. But let's bring it back to Trump. So, you know, there's a lot of stuff. If you want to look at the classical case of fascism, you know, does he have a mass party? Does he have a mass movement, you know, backing him? You know, you talk about this sort of patrimonial thing, and I think that's really the charismatic leader in a patrimonial state. I find that very attractive. I don't know if you see that as important today, and whether or not, you know, it fits with, you know, there's Trump. There's the movement, and then there's even the leaders of the movement, say, who are doing Project 2025. They're not all the same thing.
Absolutely. They're absolutely not the same thing. And so I think that Trump, it's a combination between the patrimonial element, which is, as you were saying, it's completely reliant on personal relationships. And actually, that is a hopeful element in a certain way, right? Because that's what that will be the basis for lots of internal conflict among the group. Because one of the functions of a bureaucracy, especially if it is oriented to a coherent ideology, is that it solves intra-group conflict among the ruling group. But a patrimonial system doesn't have those mechanisms, right? Everything has to do with the relationship to Trump. But what's distinctive in this second version of Trump, I think, is the existence of what appears to be more of a plan and more of a cadre. That was the thing that was missing pretty much absolutely in the first term. But remember that in the, they've really had 4 years now to figure out who they want to hire, how they're going to implement the purge of the federal bureaucracy, and who the people are who are going to take those places, right? And they've got a whole plan for what they want to do to each one of the agencies. So that's a distinctive and new element. Our greatest hope, I think, is that Trump's kind of personalism will undermine and get in the way of that project, especially as it becomes clear how profoundly unpopular it will be, because it will be profoundly unpopular. I mean, that actually, I'm pretty confident in saying that.
So, but you're kind of saying in a way that, you know, I think the dysfunction, misfunction, and chaos that Trump will bring to anything is actually good for all of us, because it's hard to live through, but it will prevent, you know, sort of the success of this, of these plans.
Absolutely. You know, the key hope is this contradiction, the contradictions that are built into the patrimonial style of rule, especially when you have a patrimonial style of rule on top of a giant capitalist state, which is, although weakened in many respects, is a kind of powerful bureaucratic organization. You try to run it that way, you're going to create all kinds of problems. And so that's what we're going to see. It's kind of, I think that's our hope. That's the check and balance.
I think we should probably, I just love, I actually really like the way that you've brought this around, and it's probably a good place to end it and to say, Dylan, that this is, you know, been a really good conversation. And now that we see, you know, because we're in early days, we don't even know, you know, how it's going to develop, but we have to come back and do this discussion again as it unfolds, because I think you have really valuable insights. So I want to thank you for joining me today, and I should just tell people Dylan is Dylan Riley, professor of sociology at Berkeley, and he does have an earlier book called The Civic Foundations of Fascism in Europe, which would be probably very good to revisit at this time as well. There's also this article in New Left Review in 2018, What is Trump? I reread it, and it's very current. And he's also got a book called Microverses and others. But just take a look, Google him, look at all these great articles. Dylan, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks a lot for having me, Susie. It was a great discussion.
Thank you.
Yeah, I'll come back anytime.
Dylan Riley, thanks for being with us on Jacobin Radio. And that's our show for today. I'd like to thank my guest, Dylan Riley. Thanks also to executive producer Robert Brenner, producer-director Melissa Figueroa, editor-engineer Juliana Gota, and Gary Baca in Master Control. You can listen to this and other archive shows, as well as subscribe to the podcast at kpfk.org. Click Audio Archives and scroll down to Beneath the Surface with Susie Wiseman. More information on programs and guests are on our Facebook page. That's Beneath the Surface with Susie Wiseman. And you've been listening to Beneath the Surface on KPFK, Pacifica Radio for all of Southern California and beyond, streaming live and archived at kpfk.org. Thanks for listening and stay tuned. I'm Susie Wiseman.
This Sunday, November 17th from 2 until 6 p.m. is the KPFK Local Station Board Town Hall Meeting at the Center for Black Power, 3349 West 43rd Street, Los Angeles, 90008 at Crenshaw Boulevard. Dr. Melina Abdullah will speak briefly about the recent elections, and then the board members want to hear from you about how KPFK can better serve the communities of Southern California. This is a great chance to meet your delegates on the LSB, KPFK programmers and management, and to speak with and to other listeners like yourself about what we can do to defend and enhance freedom of speech, cultural expression, and the press in the coming period. More information is on the station website at kpfk.org.
How do you do, ladies and gentlemen? My name is Alfred Hitchcock.
I'm John Santana. Join me next time for Cinema Score, when we'll hear music from films directed by Alfred Hitchcock, including The 39 Steps, The Lady Vanishes, Lifeboat, and more. Sunday evening at 5, here on KPFK 90.7.
To engage in any activity
that shall contribute
to a lasting